From the studios of KALW in San Francisco, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of Donald Trump's massive spending and tax cut plan. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, the Trump tax plan would give the wealthiest Americans $2.1 trillion in tax cuts. Also, Bloomberg is reporting that House Republican members of the Energy and Commerce Committee have a new version of their major Obamacare repeal and replacement bill. They just don't want you to see it. It is available to members, but only in a dedicated reading room. So theatrics aside, what is the Republican plan? Today we are joined by two journalists. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. David is the author of six books, including his latest bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump. David is founder and editor of DCReport.org. This is a new outlet that aims to arm you with information you need about what the government is up to and what you can do about it. David is also a former New York Times reporter, and David K. Johnston joins us from New York. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Trudy Lieberman, a longtime healthcare reporter and contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy is also lead writer for the Second Opinion, CJR's healthcare desk, and she blogs for Health News Review. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Great to have both of you. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that really stood out this week. So, Trudy, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I saw a piece from Kaiser Health News by Sarah Varney, and she did a very lovely investigation of how the hospitals will fare if Obamacare is repealed and the hospitals lose the money that they're getting from patients who now have a way to pay for health care. And I thought she did a really good job of going around the country and talking to a lot of different hospitals, including urban and rural hospitals, and particularly rural hospitals that have been very hard hit by a lot of this stuff that's been going on. And so I think that she wins my vote for the week.
And so what was the overall assessment from the people she interviewed?
That basically the hospitals stand a lot to lose if this is repealed and people no longer have a way to pay for their health care, and particularly if Medicaid is changed in some fashion that will make it less generous for people, and so people will have less good coverage and fewer dollars and less ability to pay for any kind of health care costs in hospitals, and I think they're quite worried about this.
All right, so kudos to Sarah Varney with Kaiser Health News. You actually have been writing about her reporting a lot lately, Trudy. You also pointed to a piece she wrote in Politico about health care in Mississippi.
Oh, yeah, that was a while back. I still write about that piece because it stands out in my mind as perhaps one of the best health policy pieces of the whole Obamacare debate that I covered almost 10 years now, going on 10 years. And she went into Mississippi and she talked about whether people were buying coverage down there, and they were not, and I think they probably still haven't. It's not one of the states that is pointed to as being a real success story with Obamacare. And there were very many memorable quotes that came from that piece she wrote, and one of them was from a woman who realized that many of the policies that she could buy down there required her to pay a lot of cost sharing, a lot of high deductibles and co-insurance and that sort of thing. And she was poor and she didn't have the money to do it. So she told Sarah, she said, this insurance ain't worth a tooth. And indeed, that problem of the high deductibles and the high cost sharing has come back to hurt Obamacare.
Mm. Well, the story that you cited is hospitals, both rural and urban, dread losing ground with health law repeal. And we'll talk more extensively about coverage of the Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare later in the show. That is Trudy Lieberman. She's a longtime healthcare reporter and contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review. And what about you, David K. Johnston? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I sent you two articles. One of them is in today's San Jose Mercury and the other Bay Area news groups, and it's very important for transparent government. The California Supreme Court has said that when government officials use a private email, if they're discussing government business, it's accessible under the California Public Records Act. Now, we've seen repeated efforts, and they're going on apparently right now in the Trump White House, to avoid disclosure of emails by using private accounts. And at least in California, the Supreme Court has said, no, we're not going to put up with that kind of subterfuge. This is a very important case for government accountability, and particularly given that in many states there is increasing efforts to withdraw data from the public record. At my news service, dcreport.org, we have reported on, and we'll be reporting more shortly, on data that's being withdrawn from the official record by the Trump administration. So at least there's this victory at the state level in California. Hmm. The second story I sent was from my hometown of Santa Cruz, up near Bonnie Doon, where I used to live in the Redwood Forest. Saturday is Salamander Day, and take your galoshes and clothes you don't mind getting covered with muddy water, and you can see the amphibians coming out because it's that time of year.
I love that, David. A good time to disconnect from the news.
Exactly.
Wow. All right. Well, we will put those stories up at yourcallradio.org. That's David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. Be sure to check out his new media venture called dcreport.org. It's an outlet that aims to arm you with the information you need about what the government's up to and what you can do about it. And David, let's dive in and talk about your new media venture. You've done a great job, lots of stories. What I love about your new venture is in the middle of the piece, there's a box, and it tells people how they can get involved, whether it's writing their congressperson, calling Scott Pruitt, for example, sending an email. Can you talk about why you decided to take on a new news venture at this time?
Well, during the campaign, I wrote a number of pieces, you had me on the air about some of them, about the failure of politics reporters to vet Donald Trump and to report on his lifelong deep involvement with one of the biggest drug traffickers in America, with Russian mobsters, American mafia, swindlers, his own well-documented history of cheating workers and vendors and investors, almost none of which made the news. And so I wrote my book, The Making of Donald Trump, which is now in 11 languages around the world. But once he became president and won the Electoral College, I was concerned that journalists, particularly because the number of journalists has shrunk so much, would focus on what Trump says and not on what government does. So what we do, and we have volunteers mostly to help us, this is a shoestring operation, frankly, that is entirely donor-supported, no ads, I'm not getting paid. So we go through the Federal Register and the Congressional Record and government websites looking for things the government is doing that you're not hearing about. One of the first things we reported on was that Donald Trump essentially forced out the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, a little but very powerful and important federal agency. This guy was in favor of integrity in electricity markets. He didn't want Wall Street gaming the markets, as happened in California back in the energy crisis 15 years ago. And he wanted the he wanted tough enforcement. And Trump forced him out. And we think that will lead to higher prices and more gaming of the markets by Wall Street energy traders. And that's just one example of a number of things that we've reported. We also, last Saturday, ahead of Rachel Maddow, ahead of The New Yorker, had a 10,000-word report detailing how Wilbur Ross, the wealthiest member of the Trump cabinet and the new Commerce Secretary, was involved up to his eyeballs with Russian money laundering and the Russian oligarchs, and understand that the Russian oligarchs are essentially a state-sponsored network of international criminals who have been doing everything they can to loot the wealth of Europe, and when they're ready, it'll be here in the U.S. And Wilbur Ross is incredibly deeply involved in them. We also wrote about some other matters involving the oligarchs' relationship with Trump, including how one of them has his own personal Airbus jet, and it kept landing the same places Donald Trump's campaign plane was landing at the same times. Hmm. Can't put them in the same room, but it is kind of odd that he was either stalking or following Trump, and this plane is normally based in Europe, in Switzerland. yet it was landing at all these airports just when Trump's plane was.
We're going to talk about Russia in a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to ask you, Trudy, when you look at a venture like DC Report, which focuses on how policy changes are going to affect people's lives, going to affect the environment, what are your thoughts? You've been a reporter for a couple of decades now, what, 30 years?
A little bit more than that.
There's so much attention on the tweets, on the lies, on the speeches, the theatrics of what the Trump administration is doing. What about reporting on policy and how people are actually going to be affected by these changes that we're seeing?
Well, historically, we've seen not very much reporting on policy, really, of any kind, whether it's tax policy or energy policy or environmental policy or healthcare policy, which I'm very familiar with. The nature of the reporting almost always is to report the politics, the horse race, the horse trading, sort of the theatrics, as you like to put it, but rarely get involved in the substance of what's going on, where the rules are going, what the regulations are, which one of the lobbyists are writing the regulations, and that's really where the policy is being made. And that's not covered very well. Sometimes I think it's by design. News outlets have always thought that this is sort of boring inside baseball stuff, and nobody really understands that. On the other hand, it's more interesting to talk about who's up, who's down. And as in my coverage of Obamacare and healthcare for the last couple of decades, that's what I've seen. And, of course, the public gets shortchanged in all of this because they haven't a clue about what's going on. And I think that that's really a disservice. And what I've always tried to do and what CJR tries to do as well is to really explain what all of this actually means for people. That's a lot harder to do because the people who can explain all this often don't want to talk anymore, and sometimes they're government officials, and as David is well aware, that it's not like it used to be where you could get people and agencies to talk to you, and now it's a lot more difficult, and it's even more difficult for seasoned reporters like us. Let alone people who are new to these various beats and don't have the experience. So that's one thing that's making more difficult. So they end up talking to various sides. Somebody's written a paper, another group's written a rebuttal paper, and so they end up writing these he said, she said kinds of stories. Well, this policy will do this, and then someone else comes and says, no, it won't. And so that leaves the reader or the viewer in the middle of all of this, not understanding a thing. Of course, until the actual law takes effect, and then they understand it. And I think that that's been the flaw in Obamacare all along, as I've written, that people didn't understand the law. It was sold by the Obama administration and people who were supporters of it with slogans that were misleading and came back to bite them in the end. And I think when people found out about some of these changes that occurred, and some of the consequences that were obvious to all of us and inevitable given the kind of structure they set up, that this was going to happen. And the public wasn't clued in. And I can tell you from another venture that I've got going, which is a rural health column that I have been writing, and now this is distributed in community newspapers in 18 states, small community newspapers primarily, and write very simple explanatory columns, such as on Medicare or how this procedure works or hospital safety or some part of Obamacare. And people are always writing to me telling me this is the first time anybody's ever explained it to them.
Wow.
So I think we have a real gap here.
That is Trudy Lieberman, longtime healthcare reporter and contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy, where can we read your rural health column online?
Well, that's a little tricky because most of it is all print. It's still distributed to these print outlets. Many of these rural papers do have an online presence, But let me research that, and maybe I can provide you with some links, Rose.
Okay, yeah, that would be great. And we're also joined today by David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. His latest book is The Making of Donald Trump, and David is the founder and editor of DCReport.org. This is a new outlet that aims to arm you with information about what the government is up to and what you can do about it. David, the other thing that I've been noticing is there's so much attention on Washington, D.C. That is really becoming the center of news. As a result, you know, you've been a local reporter. What are we missing here with so much attention on D.C.?
Well, you know, there are always more stories we can do, but it's actually incredibly important right now that we have intense coverage of the Trump administration and the Trump White House. This connection with the Russians is stunningly important. And, you know, to paraphrase Richard Nixon, people have got to know their president is not a traitor. People have got to know their president isn't compromised. And we need to understand the full measure of Donald Trump's very deep, three-decades-long involvement with the Russian oligarchs, his financial dealings with them, et cetera. And so, while there are issues all over the country need to be covered, I actually think this is, for the future of our republic, the most important thing going on today, the most important story.
Well, talk a little bit about Russia, because it's getting nonstop attention. I've got the front page of the New York Times in front of me. Top of the fold, Sessions recuses himself from Russia investigation. There are two stories here. Sessions and Russia is leading NPR, the BBC, top story on right. every major paper. What are your thoughts, David, about the angle that reporters are covering, what we know, and what you think should be the focus?
Well, I think the focus here is very good, and the big stories that have dropped recently, for example, the New York Times story yesterday or the night before last, that the Obama administration, when it began to realize from telecommunications intercepts how extensive the contacts were between people around Trump and Russian diplomats, Russian intelligence sources, Russian business people, all of whom owe their fortunes to the good graces of the murderous autocrat Vladimir Putin, and other connections, were so alarmed about this that they did something that is absolutely extraordinary. They made sure that many people in the 17 intelligence agencies had this data out of concern that the Trump administration might come in and simply delete the records if it was only in one or two places to cover up what was going on. That, to me, is the most important news story that has occurred this year. The thought that Barack Obama, an institutionalist, who even if he believed in his heart that Donald Trump was a complete agent of Vladimir Putin, I'm not saying he is, I'm saying if he believed that, would still peacefully have power handed over to the next president. His administration was so concerned that they made sure there were multiple copies of these records and as many people within the intelligence community as possible knew, because he trusted that the system would out. And we've never had a president of the United States, first of all, with Donald Trump's serious psychological issues and history of lying and criminal behavior, but much more importantly than that, his fealty to Vladimir Putin and his supporting Vladimir Putin's objectives. We just heard that the Swedish government, with the support of all the parties, is reinstituting its draft because of their concerns about Russian aggression. The leaders of the governments in the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, have been telling every journalist who will listen to them, we're worried that the Russians are going to take our country over just as they did Crimea. Donald Trump has repeated what is manufactured, completely made-up nonsense from the Russian propaganda site Sputnik. And that site, among other things, has been trying to persuade people in Belarus that Polish soldiers are invading Belarus, which is complete nonsense. The leading right-wing French candidate for president in France, Ms. Le Pen, is being financed by Putin's regime. This is the biggest and most important thing going on in the world, that we have a president of the United States who keeps expressing fealty and admiration and support for someone who is an enemy of our country and of Western Europe and of democracy.
David, where should people go to find the best information about these connections?
Well, first of all, I think the reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post and a little bit in the Wall Street Journal has been superb. And there's clearly a competitive newspaper war going on, which is good for the public. Secondly, at our website, DC Report, there's this very long report by James Henry that with lots of footnotes that I encourage people to read. And then there was an earlier report James Henry did, which I edited for American Interest magazine, American-Interest, and it's called The Curious Connections of the Oligarchs and Trump. And those two long articles will give you an incredibly thorough picture of Trump's connections. And there's a lot more to come out. I mean, we know that Donald Trump continues right up until a couple of weeks ago to be connected to Felix Sater, a twice-convicted felon who puts Donald Trump personally one degree of separation from terrorists moving Stinger missiles. One degree of separation from the people moving these missiles to Donald Trump, and that's Felix Sater. So the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and our website, I think you'll get a pretty solid picture of how troublesome this is and why it's imperative that we have a bipartisan, public, with subpoena power investigation run by seasoned professional investigators.
And one more question on this, David. What do you think about the Democrats focusing on Russians meddling in the elections, but not on the financial connections that you've been talking about?
Well, I think they're beginning to shift towards that. What the Democrats have been doing is following what we know, and bit by bit more is coming out. And I'm absolutely certain you're going to see big stories over the next few weeks in both the New York Times and the Washington Post, just because having worked at the Times and the LA Times, I know, as Trudy will also say, how these things work. They take time. There are people leaking left and right who obviously are deeply concerned about the loyalties of the president, which at an absolute minimum are divided between Washington and Moscow. And if you go on YouTube and look at the video of the members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees walking out of their two-hour briefing from James Comey, the FBI director, about what FBI counterintelligence learned, I mean, they look shell-shocked coming out of that room. So clearly, they know that there are serious major issues here that the Trump administration is working desperately hard to bat away and say, there's nothing there, there's nothing there. Pay no attention. There's smoke, but there's no fire. Pay no attention.
And David, we get a lot of emails from listeners who say that there's too much of a focus on Russia. And, you know, that journalists are focusing specifically on Russia. What about other countries where the U.S. has meddled in their political process?
Well, all big countries meddle in other countries. We removed the constitutionally elected president in Chile during the Nixon administration. We have sent in troops all over Latin America for years. What does that have to do with whether the president of the United States is loyal to Vladimir Putin and not to the American people? I mean, this is a false comparison. All of the other stuff is true, but so what? We cannot have a president of the United States who is disloyal and who is advancing the interests of a declared enemy of our country and of Western Europe and of the very concept of democracy.
And to people who say that that journalists and the Democrats are promoting a phobia about Russia as a big enemy?
Well, the evidence is that we should be concerned. Look what Russia has done. Russia invaded Crimea. Putin has made it clear in his public statements in his own country that he intends to rebuild most of the old Soviet empire by taking back those areas that are primarily Russian-speaking. We have seen what's happened in the occupation of Ukraine, in the shooting down of a civilian jetliner, in a whole host of actions, in undermining with the use of the internet Western democracies. This is the matter of phobia about Russia. It's about who the leader of that country is, a man who murders his political opponents, a man who on a $100,000 salary has amassed a fortune of tens of billions of dollars. You know, he's as corrupt as you can possibly be and is creating a cult of Putin in his country where he controls the news media, thoroughly controls it.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author of 6 books, including his latest bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump. He's founder and editor of DCReport.org. This is a new outlet. We're also joined by Trudy Lieberman, longtime healthcare reporter and contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. And after the break, we will talk about leaks coming out of the administration. We'll talk about Trump's tax plan and the Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. What is their plan? This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on local public radio, KALW San Francisco, online at kalw.org. The resources you hear on today's program will be posted at the yourcall.org website. And if you have any comments, you can add your comments there. Send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by two journalists discussing the week's news. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of The Making of Donald Trump, and founder and editor of DC Report. This is a new outlet that aims to arm you with information you need about what the government is up to and what you can do about it. We're also joined by Trudy Lieberman, a longtime healthcare reporter and contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. She also writes a rural healthcare column. And Trudy, David brought up leaks before the show or before the break, and I wanted to ask you about leaks because Reuters has a piece this morning, Trump aides' bid to plug leaks creates unease among civil servants. And here's the lead. Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin used his first senior staff meeting to tell new aides he would not tolerate leaks to the news media. Current and former officials said that in a departure from past practices, access to a classified computer system at the White House has been tightened by political appointees to prevent staffers from seeing memos being prepared by the new president. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, we've seen an unprecedented amount of leaks coming out of the White House.
Well, I think leaks have always been with us as journalists. I mean, I've gotten tons of leaks in my career, and I think David probably has too, and that's sort of where we get our information. It takes a very brave person in a bureaucracy to do that. But when you get them, they usually pan out, not always, but most of the time they pan out. And I think the people who are doing the leaking generally feel pretty strongly that this is information that needs to go out. Now, if you're sitting in the White House as the president or your Secretary of the Treasury, of course you don't want to see very many leaks come out, particularly about stuff you really do want to keep secret, because that can be kind of detrimental to your program, ultimately. So there's always been this tension between the leaks and the leakers and those in power. So I don't think that's ever going to change. And we certainly are going to see more of it because Trump is not particularly popular. And I'm sure that in the bureaucracy, there are a lot of people who are not in agreement with certain policies and will do whatever they can to get that out to the press. And I think the public will probably be the beneficiaries of all of that. And knowing Washington like I do and other places, reporters are going to be sniffing around like crazy to get them. And we certainly have seen this in terms of the Health Care Act, because the Republicans' plan, one of their plans, has been leaked a week or so ago and has given the public and the people in the know in Washington who really care about this stuff that what they plan to do. And I think before that, it was always kind of nebulous. We knew that they were going to sort of dismantle several parts of Obamacare, but now we have a little bit more precision about what kind of dismantling they want to do. And so I do believe that there was somebody on one of those committees that wanted this thing out. Now, that said, things can change. That's not necessarily the way the law is going to be written in the final analysis when the lobbyists get together and they do the markups and all that happens behind closed doors. But I do think that sometimes you at least know what's going to happen. And if you're on the other side, as this was explained to me once by somebody, you really don't want your information to come out and let everybody take pot shots at it and sort of weaken it before it ever gets to final bill drafting. And I think that there's a danger now with the health care law that that could happen, that there's going to be so many people opposing many of these provisions that they may not be able to get them through.
Well, let's talk about that, because Bloomberg reported yesterday that House Republican members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee have a new version of their major Obamacare replacement bill, but they don't want you to see it. It's available in a room to members and staffers. And then there's a lot of coverage today about Senator Rand Paul bringing a photocopier to Congress, trying to get his hands on the bill and then passing it out. But theatrics aside, Trudy, what is actually in the bill? What do we need to know about it?
Well, there are several things that people really do need to know about it, because it's going to affect almost everybody, including people who have employer-provided coverage. The two biggest things that are likely to change are the tax credits and the pre-existing conditions requirements for Obamacare. And as your listeners may recall, that these two provisions are really the keystones of Obamacare, that people who could not afford private insurance sold by private commercial carriers would get subsidies from the government keyed to their income level that would help them buy policies. People who had very low incomes would receive greater amounts of help from the government. People who had greater incomes would receive fewer subsidies. The other thing that Obamacare did was change the individual insurance market to require companies to sell insurance to people who were sick. And this is the pre-existing conditions issue. Before Obamacare, insurance companies did not want to insure people who had cancer, kids that had ear infections, people with heart disease, and so on, and even very minor ailments, you couldn't get insurance. And so what they would do is say they were not going to sell any insurance to those people, or they would charge them a higher premium, or they would say they would cover them for other conditions other than the ones they had. Well, this was very unacceptable to the framers of the ACA, and so they got Congress to kind of change the law. But this has kind of backfired in a way, and all of this was sort of predictable because this is a private market, remember? And insurance companies are in business to make money. They're not charitable institutions. So they have not been making a lot of money on these sick people that they have been insuring. And in fact, what's happened is that so many sick people have come in and too few healthy people, younger people, have come into their markets that they are raising the premiums a whole lot. And people have been very unhappy about that. So the Republican plan is going to change those two keystones very substantially. And what they are likely to do is say that instead of a tax credit based on income, you're going to get one based on age. And if that happens, it's going to favor people at the with higher incomes and people who are older. Well, people at the lower incomes are not going to do as well. So that's one thing that's likely to happen. And some of the think tanks in Washington are coming up with their studies saying that what likely is to happen, that some people, younger people, will be able to buy insurance that will cover maybe 70% of they will get a subsidy, a tax credit that will cover 70% of the cost of the policy, while older people would get a subsidy that would cover only 25%. So you can see what that's going to do to older people. It's going to make them pay more, and they are the ones that are going to have the greater health conditions that need to get covered. The other thing that's likely to happen is that pre-existing conditions requirements will be altered somewhat. Now, the Republicans have made a big deal about saying that they're not going to change pre-existing conditions, and probably they won't, but they're going to make another modifications in that requirement that people will have to be very careful about whether they're going to get a policy or not. Right now, anybody who's sick can get a policy, whether they stay insured or not. They can come into the market, stay for a while, get whatever they need fixed, go out of the market, and then come back in. Well, insurance companies don't like that very much because it doesn't make their risk pool very stable. So they've been working on Congress to try to get that changed, and that is probably going to change in so that people who have a pre-existing condition have to stay insured all the time. If they leave the market for any reason, for whatever length of time the law specifies, and then comes back into the market, they will have to pay a much higher premium, perhaps 30 or 50%, maybe even more, to get their insurance back. And that's definitely a way to penalize them and to keep them from going in and out of the market, which is what insurance companies don't like. So those two provisions are geared to make things better for insurance companies, but not necessarily better for ordinary people. So Obamacare, in that sense, was a much better arrangement than what's likely to happen under the Republicans.
And David, as Trudy is explaining, there's a lot on the line here. What are your thoughts about how reporters are giving people information about how they'll be affected? Because Sarah Oakson wrote a story for your new news outlet, DC Report. And the other thing I like about your stories is there's a box in brief that basically summarizes the piece. And in this case, it's they cannot repeal Obamacare, so the Trump White House wants to make it much harder for you to get health insurance with it.
Yes, and this is one of the things you're going to see and not see covered well, unfortunately. The Obama administration is moving to require you, if you're married, to prove by producing a marriage license that you're married, or birth certificates for your children and other paperwork. And the head of one of the exchanges said, this is a complete waste of time. A study done by the GAO showed there's no evidence of any fraud in this area. And when you apply for insurance, you sign under penalty of perjury. So if you're lying, the other member of your household is not legally your spouse and not entitled to coverage, we can go after you for that. This is creating more paperwork and difficulty. But, you know, embedded in Trudy's comments, and nobody understands health care in the journalism world the way Trudy does. She is the gold standard and has been for decades. When she was at Consumer Reports and ever since then on this, clear back to when we were both reporters at the Detroit Free Press in the early 70s, is this concern about insurance companies. And I would simply argue that insurance companies are a superfluous industry that we should do away with. And Donald Trump himself once said to me years ago, when I asked him about health insurance, he said, well, it should be like driving down the road. You know, you need it, you just use it. That is, he believed in universal, no out-of-pocket health care funded through the government because it's the most efficient way to do so. We spend 6 percentage points of our economy more on health care than the French, who have the best system in the world, than the Germans, who have one of the best systems in the world, than most modern countries, because it's an inefficient, sick care non-system that makes no sense whatsoever, and we should get rid of this and recognize that it's a drain on business. When I started my hotel management company with my oldest son, or his company, and I helped him start it, I spent enormous amounts of time trying to figure out health care for the only two workers who were full-time, and it was a complete waste of time. We should take this off the backs of business and recognize what every other modern country has recognized.
Well,
you
want to
do this in the most efficient way, and the most efficient way to do that is to have a system where we don't have insurance companies. We don't need them. We don't need to have a profit motive here.
I think there's one way to think about this, because I think this is an important point that David is making. There are really four approaches that the U.S. can use or has used to covering people to provide health insurance. One of them is Obamacare, which is kind of a middle of the road. I would call it like a number three kind of way we did it. We brought more people into the insurance under the insurance umbrella, but we didn't go all the way. under Obamacare, we still have about 30 million people uninsured with no prospect of them getting coverage anytime soon. So now come along the Republicans, and they want to kind of decimate what Obamacare did and probably result in a lot fewer people having coverage. And even that kind of plan is way too strong for the Freedom Caucus and many of the very conservative Republicans in Congress who don't want to give anybody any kind of subsidy or tax credit to buy insurance because they say it's going to be, quote, a permanent entitlement. And that's probably the lowest level you can get. Now, we're talking about moving down, 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 rather than moving up, up, up. And at the top of this is what I think David is talking about, is something like the French system or the German system, Canadians, whatever you want. And that would be a full-fledged national health insurance system. And what I think is ironic at this point is that nobody is talking about this, not even the people who at once supported this, which is just mystifying to me. And if you go out on the street and ask people if they know what national health insurance or single payer, which was the euphemism for it for many years, is, they say they don't know. In fact, I've had very intelligent people ask me, what is single payer? Mm-hmm. And these people just never heard the term. They don't know what it is. They don't know how to get it. They don't know anything about it. So I think this is, says a lot about where we have come as a country in terms of what we want for our health care arrangements. And I think we're going to go in a very opposite direction than the one David talks about and the one I personally think we ought to go to.
Well, last month, California State Senator Ricardo Lara introduced a bill that would create a single-payer health care system here in California.
Well, they've been trying to do that in California
for years, right.
But it never goes anywhere because the insurance industry doesn't want it. The medical profession definitely doesn't want it. The business community doesn't want it for reasons I don't understand, and David kind of alluded to some of them. There's no constituency for it. And what we're going to do on the Medicaid side, we're going to take insurance away from some of the very poorest people under these block grant and per capita spending arrangements. So what we're going to happen, what I fear is going to happen, is that we're going to have a real throwback to what we had way before Obamacare was passed, with a lot more people without coverage, and the price of medical care going through the roof because we have no way to control costs.
Trudy Lieberman is a longtime healthcare reporter and contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. You can read her latest pieces about healthcare at yourcallradio.org. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of The Making of Donald Trump, founder and editor of DCReport.org, a new outlet that aims to arm you with information you need about what the government's up to and what you can do about it. David, what about reporting on taxes and healthcare? The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities reports that eliminating two ACA Medicare taxes means very large tax cuts for the wealthy. It'll give every millionaire a $49,000 tax break.
Well, part of the theory of the Affordable Care Act was that those people with the highest incomes are beneficiaries of the whole economy, and they should bear part of the cost of providing health care for people who either can't afford it or have not been able to get access to it. There's a second provision that Trudy has just written about, and a very important one, the so-called Cadillac tax, where if you have a very expensive health care plan, the kind that executives tend to have, you will pay a premium for this. And all of this, it goes to this Rube Goldberg approach we take to health care in America, driven by the power and the influence and the lobbying of, first and foremost, the insurance companies, secondly, the hospitals, both profit and nonprofit hospitals, and thirdly, the physicians. And it is not being covered well at all. One of the things I find shocking is when I go do public lectures and this comes up, is how many Americans have no idea that there's quality health care that other countries have at much lower prices than we do. We've failed as journalists to get this across to people, and I think that's because, as Trudy mentioned earlier, journalists are focused on the horse race, on the he said, she said, on the controversy, not on the policy and the issues.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk just a second about the Cadillac tax, because it has been totally omitted by journalists in the last several weeks. I mean, they're just not covering it. They didn't cover it initially, and they're not covering it now.
And Trudy, David mentioned the Cadillac tax and briefly described it, but can you also describe it? I'm guessing a lot of people have no idea what it is.
Yeah, of course not. It is a tax that employers will have to pay on the value of their employer-provided coverage, and that coverage goes to 177 million Americans have employer-provided health insurance. The tax is very high. It's a 40% tax above certain thresholds. And what is going to happen if it's not repealed is that these health plans, the employers that everybody works for, are going to do what they can to lower their benefit packages, give less coverage, so that they stay under the tax and don't have to pay it. That's sort of normal business response to that sort of thing. So what's going to happen is that people who think they have good coverage now, few deductibles, not very much cost sharing, a lot of choice, all that sort of thing, wide networks, providers, are going to find all of that changing rather rapidly. And as someone from one of the business groups has pointed out, is that it's not just people with the so-called Cadillac plans, the richer benefit packages. It's going to hurt a lot of people who have less coverage because they work in industries where there are very costly workers, like a lot of women, a lot of young women of childbearing age, or there's a lot of people who work there in risky jobs. For example, coal mining comes to mind, but there are many, many others. And so those people are likely to have greater medical costs. And they are the ones that are going to suffer too under this tax, and so it's going to hit everybody. And most of the people think that eventually, in the next few years, if the tax goes forward, almost every employer plan will be hit. So it's not just a question of a few benefits disappearing under Obamacare. It's going to hurt everybody in the end if this tax isn't removed. Now, the question then becomes, what's going to replace it? Because that tax went a long way toward subsidizing the people without insurance. And the business community says that's not our problem. We're going to let the Congress figure that out. And I guess that they're going to try to do that if they repeal this tax. And I'm trying to urge reporters to look into this, because taxes are really very important, and the incidence of the tax, who pays the tax, is really super important, because a lot of people are going to end up paying it one way or the other. And all of this is a way of saying that if we're going to provide these subsidies, then we really do have to figure out some equitable way to pay for it. And the Obamacare people, I guess, thought they were doing it, or the economists advising Obama and his people thought they had a way to do it. But when you look at it, it has a lot of negative consequences for lots of people.
And then connecting that to Donald Trump's tax plan, David, just quickly, you wrote a column for the Daily Beast called Donald Trump's Fake Math. And according to Citizens for Tax Justice, Trump's tax plan would give the wealthiest Americans a $2 trillion in tax cuts. You say, let's call this what it is, fake math.
Yes, Trump is promising massive increases in spending, infrastructure, military, a whole bunch of other things. He says he wants to keep one of the costliest provisions of the Affordable Care Act, and at the same time, he wants to have much bigger tax cuts than we had under George W. Bush for people at the top. Yet he ran against increasing the federal debt. His campaign was, oh, we can't afford this debt, we have no other choice, and yet his plans would massively increase the red ink. Under Obama, the federal government's annual deficit came way down. The total debt rose because we still had deficits. The fact is, we are not taxing ourselves enough to pay for the services that we are getting and by who we elect want to get from our government. And Trump is basically saying that 2 + 2 = -1. That's not gonna work in the real world. The algebra doesn't work, and we ought to start calling it fake math, just like we talk about fake news.
David, we have a question from a listener who says, I'm still waiting to see an insightful piece of true investigative journalism that shows how what Donald Trump did was brilliant. He defeated the Bushes and then he defeated the Clintons. He broke so many norms of decency along the way, and ultimately it seems clear to so many of us that he truly conned the American people with his brand of populism. Can you comment on the brilliance of what he pulled off and what it means for the prospects of his administration more generally?
Yeah. I mean, without question, Donald set out with a plan and pulled off a very smart move. He lost the popular vote, but he won the Electoral College. He himself was surprised. On the last day, you know, the day of voting, he was telling people in his family and elsewhere, you know, that he expected that he was not going to win. The polls actually were accurate about this. But he exploited the problems the Republicans had. He posed as a Republican. He's not a Republican by any stretch of the imagination. And there had been a number of pieces written going through his campaign. I'm doing a new book on Trump for Simon & Schuster that will be out at the end of this year, and that will certainly talk about how he pulled this off. I'd also point out that Hillary Clinton didn't follow a basic rule of warfare, whether it's political warfare or shooting warfare. She didn't adjust her game plan to address what Trump was doing. She didn't recognize that a whole lot of former blue-collar workers or blue-collar workers in fear of losing their jobs couldn't stand Trump, but they believed he was going to be their savior. They didn't notice that he kept saying wages are too high, and they turned out to vote, and she did not adapt to that at all.
And so you're writing a new book about that.
I'm doing a book about Trump through May 1st for Simon & Schuster that'll be out at the end of the year.
Such important angles that need to be explored. Just quickly, David, what are you working on right now?
Well, I just turned in an extra column for the Daily Beast. The first new data on incomes has come out from 2015, and what it shows is that in 2013, when we raised taxes on the top 1%, and in 2014, when the Obamacare began, median wages began to rise, that people in the lower half began to benefit, that most of the gains that have gone on in the last couple of years in both the number of jobs we have and in wages have been benefiting people in the lower half, completely contradicts Donald Trump's campaign positions. We're still way behind where we should be from the mid-1990s, even before the bubble at the end of the 90s, because government policies are subtly redistributing from many up to the very top, and we have an uneven economy as a result. People at the top with more money they know what to do with, and lots of people who are constrained in terms of their income and their assets, unnecessarily constrained.
And David K. Johnston is founder and editor of DC Report, a new outlet that arms you with information you need about the government and what you can do about it. And Trudy Lieberman is a longtime healthcare reporter, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. She just posted a new story about media's coverage of Obamacare and the questions they're not asking. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. David and Trudy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.